body politic that was still convinced of the rightness of the nation's staggering overreaction to the terrorist attacks through the war in Iraq and the expanding securitization of American life. I'd come to Washington to connect my own life to my nation's response to 9/11. But what was my nation becoming? Just a few days after the release of the report, the Democratic National Convention was held in Boston. 42-year-old Barack Obama had just won his Senate primary in Illinois and was slated to be the keynote speaker. In his remarks, he said, "I stand here knowing that my story is part of the larger American story, that I owe a debt to all those who came before me, and that in no other country on earth is my story even possible." This was the story that I wanted to believe. Where else would a Kenyan foreign student marry a young white woman and have a kid named Barack who would end up on the biggest stage in national politics? There was something different about the American story, but it wasn't the arc of military and geopolitical triumph from Wilson to Reagan. It was a struggle to better ourselves, to right the historical wrongs of people like Wilson, who'd embraced segregation, or Reagan, who represented the conservative counter-revolution to the civil rights movement. Obama went on. "That is the true genius of America, a faith in simple dreams, an insistence on small miracles. That we can tuck in our children at night and know that they are fed and clothed and safe from harm. That we can say what we think, write what we think, without hearing a sudden knock on the door. That we can have an idea and start our own business without paying a bribe. That we can participate in the political process without fear of retribution, and that our votes will be counted, at least most of the time." To me, these sounded like the words of someone who wasn't far removed from places where there could be a sudden knock on the door, places where you couldn't start a business without paying a bribe. Someone who knew those kinds of things didn't just happen in Russia, they could happen in America too. Instead of grandiose platitudes, this description of freedom felt grounded in reality and the need to guard against complacency. Even the line at the end, at least most of the time, showed a politician bringing you in on the joke, the knowledge that part of the whole enterprise isn't on the level, and we know that. "If there is a child on the south side of Chicago who can't read, that matters to me, even if it's not my child. If there's a senior citizen somewhere who can't pay for their prescription drugs and has to choose between medicine and the rent, that makes my life poorer, even if it's not my grandparent. If there's an Arab American family being rounded up without benefit of an attorney or due process, that threatens my civil liberties." Here was an America of underdogs, living on the other end of power, rather than the possession of a privileged few seeking aggrandizement through foreign adventures. The inclusion of the one sentence about Arab Americans contained, in its own way, a rebuke of America's post-9/11 excesses. The obvious, even banal, rightness of these images made our failure to live up to that truth both inexcusable and correctable. The proper work of politics. "We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around in our libraries in the red states. We coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we've got some gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who opposed the war in Iraq, and there are patriots who supported the war in Iraq." After I'd spent 2 years reviewing the pieces of America's response to 9/11, including the faulty efforts to transform distant countries, this was a plea to pay attention to what kind of country we were supposed to be in the first place. It was a politics that inverted the jingoism of the post-9/11 Bush years, the patriotism of flag lapel pins, freedom fries, and flyovers at football games. Those words spoke to the reality of a country that contains multitudes of identities, because individuals themselves contain multitudes. That was America to me, a place where you could be yourself in full because we respected one another's equal worth. The opposite of us versus them. Just us. I printed the speech out and put it in a small folder that I kept in a drawer at my office, to be taken out from time to time for inspiration, distraction, or just a reminder. A few weeks after the Democratic Convention, a group of heavily armed Chechen militants took more than 1,000 people hostage, including nearly 800 children, at a school in the Russian town of Beslan. The perpetrators demanded an end to Russia's war in Chechnya. 2 days later, Russian security forces stormed the school in a chaotic operation that led to the death of nearly 200 children. To the American observer, it was one more horrific terrorist attack in our shared post-9/11 reality. But in truth, it was much more than that. It came at a time when Putin had tightened his fist around the gears of the Russian state and hardened his view of global affairs because of the war in Iraq, which confirmed his belief that America's post-Cold War project was an expansionist effort to depose whatever government opposed our hegemony, including Russia's. Just because that view may have been overstated and subsequently used to justify all manner of Putin's crimes and aggressions doesn't mean it didn't contain a germ of truth, or that it wasn't genuinely believed by Putin himself, a man whose life had been spent in the darker shadows of political power. Sitting in my windowless office at the Wilson Center, I read the speech that Putin had delivered 2 days after the catastrophe of Beslan. Then I printed it out and read it again and again. I put it in the same folder as Obama's convention speech, where it stayed for the next several years until I packed up my things and went to work for the Obama campaign. Every now and then, I would read it in the silence of my office. There was something chilling and resonant about that speech. The language was simple and direct. It signaled a clear direction. It showed a leader fully revealing himself and his agenda to his people and the world. Putin began with the expected reference to the terrorist attack, the loss of children, the condolences for the families. Then he told a story. There have been many tragic pages and difficult trials in the history of Russia. Today, we are living in conditions formed after the disintegration of a huge, great country. The country which unfortunately turned out to be non-viable in the conditions of a rapidly changing world. Today, however, despite all difficulties, we managed to preserve the nucleus of that giant, the Soviet Union. We called the new country the Russian Federation. Putin wasn't telling people what one might expect at the conclusion of such a horrifying tragedy. Children gunned down in the crossfire of a military assault on suicidal terrorists. Instead, he was telling them what he believed they needed to know about who they are, what they've been through, and what kind of world it is. Whether you're a Kaliningrad woman selling vodka and cigarettes on the black market, an outraged resident of Beslan, or just some guy who lost his pension around the collapse of the Soviet Union. The tragedy is not Beslan. The tragedy is what happened to Russia. The tragedy is the loss of the Soviet Union. We all expected changes, changes for the better, but found ourselves absolutely unprepared for much that changed in our lives. The question is why. We live in conditions of a transitional economy and a political system that do not correspond to the development of society. We live in conditions of aggravated internal conflicts and ethnic conflicts that before were harshly suppressed by the governing ideology. We stopped paying due attention to issues of defense and security. We allowed corruption to affect the judiciary and law enforcement systems. In addition to that, our country, which once had one of the mightiest systems of protecting its borders, suddenly found itself unprotected from west or east. From the fall of the Soviet Union to Beslan, Putin was suggesting, a great nation had been brought to its knees. Russia had abandoned communism and dictatorship, and the transitional economy and political system that followed had failed. The Soviet Union used to suppress the kinds of internal and ethnic conflicts that now came to haunt places like Beslan. The Soviet Union used to be respected and secure in its borders, but now America was illegally invading Iraq, while America's NATO Trojan horse was swallowing up former Soviet republics. Just that summer, the three Baltic nations had joined NATO. Of course the Soviet Union was flawed. That was why people expected changes. Changes for the better. But that is not what had happened. Beyond the brief reference to corruption, Putin did not have to say anything more about what actually happened in the 1990s. Those were things that Russians felt in their bones. To Putin, these were the real perpetrators of Beslan, the people, nations, and forces that robbed Russia of its strength and dignity, that left it so naked and vulnerable that people were taking children hostage, while America was knocking over Russian allies from Belgrade to Baghdad. Nor was Putin shy about blaming Russians themselves, himself included. We found ourselves absolutely unprepared. Then his argument reached its perfectly distilled crescendo, a simple assertion of worldview. The most powerful thing that a leader can do is tell people a hard truth with the conviction that they already believe it to be true. Phrased wrong, it can insult, leaving people with the sense that the leader is shifting the blame onto them. But when it is done right, it can open a new space for the leader. It does not necessarily matter whether the hard truth is entirely true. Putin had his story of Russia after the fall of the Soviet Union, but someone like Nemtsov could have told a different one about poor choices, a lack of sound governance, the failure to embrace necessary reforms, the corruption of the gray men from the intelligence and security services. History looks very different, depending upon which window you open to look at it. What matters in politics is whether the person speaking can convince you that he believes what he is saying, whether he conveys a convincing explanation for what has happened and a sense of what needs to happen. In just a few sentences, Putin did this, offering a thesis statement for his political project and all that he has done since. We have to admit that we failed to recognize the complexity and danger of the processes going on in our own country and the world as a whole. At any rate, we failed to react to them adequately. We demonstrated weakness, and the weak are beaten. We demonstrated weakness, and the weak are beaten. In these conditions, Putin continued, we simply cannot, we should not, live as carelessly as before. Russia was moving into a new epoch, beyond the chaos of the post-Cold War years, one that required a complex of measures aimed at strengthening the unity of our country. Those measures would include an end to the direct election of governors, so they could be handpicked by the Kremlin. New rules for parliamentary elections that favored his party, United Russia. New laws that cracked down on foreign-funded NGOs. What mattered was that Russia had to come together as an us, with Putin at the helm, to take on them. Terrorists, yes, but also the American-led post-Cold War forces that had humiliated Russia. The counter-revolution had begun. It's a peculiar coincidence of history that these two speeches were delivered within a few weeks of each other. Think about how many words are said every single day. The endless arguments, snippets of conversation, and seemingly important public assertions that disappear as soon as the sound fades. How rare it is for sentences strung together to signal some new direction that can be recognized from the future. In a way, these two speeches anticipated the extent to which the West was approaching a collapse of the post-Cold War consensus, a process that had been accelerated by 9/11 and Iraq, and that would reach its breaking point with the 2008 financial crisis. Both Obama and Putin were trying to tap into people's desire for a new story that offered belonging, purpose and a sense of possibility. Both Obama and Putin were speaking from a perspective informed by the failure of the Iraq War. Both Obama and Putin described what made their nations exceptional. But their answers, their stories, and their politics led in opposite directions that continue to shape our political debates almost two decades later. Putin would stop paying attention to words and rules that were inconvenient, acting with the brute force and disregard for international opinion that characterized America's invasion of Iraq. Russia would invade Georgia in 2008 and Ukraine in 2014. It would also weaponize those aspects of the American order that suited its purposes: oil wealth, the corruption afforded by capitalism, the limitless propaganda function of the internet and social media. Years later, just before I left Washington, I had coffee with a journalist who had spent a lot of time looking at Russia's use of disinformation. I described how it had taken years for me to understand the psychological toll that came from a daily bombardment of messages on social media that dehumanized and threatened me. How it was impossible to know what was someone's real voice and what was automated, what was American and what was Russian. "That's part of the point, right?" he said. "To demoralize the opponent." As obvious as that was, it had never occurred to me in quite that way before, that my mental state was one tiny front in a war that Putin had been waging since Beslan, that he had projected back onto America what he found ugly about us, and in turn shaped us into something that bore a closer resemblance to his view of the world, a place in which truth and individual human beings are incidental to the raw will to power. 10. The system is rigged. When I first connected with Alexei Navalny over FaceTime, he asked with dark humor and a trace of condescension if I was writing a book about how to do color revolutions better. He was using the term for the popular uprisings for democracy that had been stymied by Russia in places like Ukraine and Georgia. The term deriving from these movements' symbolic use of a particular color or flower. I sensed that he was simultaneously mocking Putin, who claims to see color revolutions being plotted everywhere. American supporters of democracy, whose enthusiasm for color revolutions and financing of civil society organizations can play into Putin's conspiracy theories. And the global media, which reduce complex movements to cartoonish shorthand. He seemed annoyed at the whole edifice. I liked him immediately. When I explained that I was more interested in understanding his brand of opposition politics through the prism of Russia's story since the Cold War, I may have risen a little in his esteem. He mentioned, as if to strike up a sense of solidarity, that he'd noticed that I had been spied on by Black Cube. He had been too, he said. He'd learned that a Russian billionaire had ordered the operation so that he could give Putin the results as a birthday present. The problem was that the Russian security services already knew everything there was to know about Navalny, a man who has been imprisoned over a dozen times and is constantly followed and harassed. Besides, he was an open book, more than happy for people to know his story. Navalny remembered becoming politically conscious as the privatization schemes of the 1990s were unfolding and the nation's wealth was being transferred to that handful of oligarchs. The America that likes to think of itself as a source of inspiration to democratic opposition figures did not make a good first impression. Instead, Navalny saw the rotating cast of American technocrats, Ivy League academics like Jeffrey Sachs and Larry Summers, and political consultants who advised Yeltsin and his top deputy, Anatoly Chubais, as, essentially, unwitting co-conspirators in screwing the Russian people. "The privatization was a fraud," Navalny said. "These people who came from the U.S., who were advisors for Yeltsin and for the Russian government, maybe they were personally not a fraud, but they worked for crooks and thieves." Most of the American accounts of that time that I'd read described Yeltsin as a flawed but well-meaning man, working with the support of Americans eager to spread democracy and free markets. Navalny said the result tells a different story. The result was a lot of billionaires, and we have nothing. We still have nothing. Yeltsin's victory in the 1996 election had been viewed as a triumph in America, a narrow defeat of the communists, a victory for our man in Moscow, who even employed American political consultants to help run his campaign. To Navalny, it was a calamity, a validation of corruption, a victory that assured that liberals would be blamed for the unraveling that continued, a dynamic that led to Putin. Navalny got a law degree and went into politics. In the early 2000s, he went to work for Yabloko, the biggest of Russia's liberal parties. As chief of staff for the Moscow branch of the party, he saw the futility of traditional politics as Putin was steadily taking control of the media, first television, then the newspapers, until self-censorship took hold among Russian journalists. Without any explicit instructions, they understand that you cannot write about these guys, he said, meaning Yabloko and the other liberal parties. Navalny would try to generate media attention for Yabloko's events and agenda, but it all felt like a waste of time. You're spending much more effort to beg journalists to write something than on the events themselves. Around 2005, as Putin's transformation of Russia was accelerating after the Beslan disaster, Navalny's attention was increasingly on corruption. Like Sándor Lederer in Budapest, he noticed the schemes that were remaking Moscow. He started talking to people across the city, getting out into neighborhoods where people were being muscled out of their homes to make way for development. They captured the yard in front of your house, and they're trying to build a skyscraper, Navalny recalled. They don't have any documentation. They're paying bribes to everyone in the mayor's office. Navalny began what would become his life's work, connecting dots for people, making them realize that their personal circumstances were directly related to a corrupt political system. He recalled how these conversations with aggrieved residents would go. Why are they taking land by your house? Because of money. Why are they paying bribes? Because of money. He established the Muscovite Protection Committee, which he described as 99% committed to fighting corruption. Navalny would demand documents legitimizing the property seizures, and the developers would refuse to provide them. They'd threaten Navalny, and then he'd sue them, only to find out that they were paying off the judge reviewing the suit. The people he was up against did not want any publicity, but even when he succeeded in generating it, they operated with impunity. Back then, Navalny recalled, people from this construction business are just thugs, mafia bosses, sometimes literally mafia bosses. It's very easy for them to hire a couple of people with baseball bats and just beat you somewhere. Putin had created the impression that he had reined in the excesses of the 90s when the press was freer, the schemes were plain to see, and the pie was smaller because oil prices were low. But as Russia got richer, the corruption was only expanding, shaping the entire system in which Russians lived. Many of the same people who once ran the Soviet Union were now getting rich in Putin's Russia, joined by the cohort of Putin's own friends and associates who could run networks of graft and criminality, drawing on their experience in the shadowy world of intelligence. The words had changed, but the song was still the same. Corruption is the essence of such a regime, Navalny told me. Lies and corruption. They're lying all the time to have more money. Of course, there is a lot of design with the ideology, he said, referring to Russian nationalism and longing for greatness lost. But they just want to be very rich men. They just want to have their palaces and their very luxurious lifestyles. Navalny's own evolving political views in the 2000s were hard to pin down. He made common cause with far-right figures and skinheads who protested Putin in marches, drawing criticism that dogs him to this day. He had a falling out with the leadership of Yabloko, which wasn't surprising since he demanded that they all resign over disagreements about the party's strategy. By his own admission, he didn't fit easily into the structure of a political party with its coalitions and consensus building. But more fundamentally, all of that political work, and even the traditional left-right debates seemed pointless when the whole system was rigged. By 2007, as Putin was preparing to hand off the presidency to his hand-picked successor, Dmitry Medvedev, Navalny was at something of a crossroads. At that point, he was just a guy with a blog, but he couldn't shake politics. He wasn't animated by any particular set of policies. What sustained him was anger. He was, he told me, determined to preserve and keep my level of rage to stay in politics. What sustained the rage? I asked him. It was lying, he said. The Soviet Union was an empire based on a lie, and Putin's Russia is a country based on a lie. He had seen it firsthand, confronting those corruption schemes in Moscow courts and finding that the legal apparatus that was supposed to enforce fairness was on the take. You are facing these people in the courts, and they are lying to you. Navalny's second act in public life, the one that launched him to prominence, was as an online anti-corruption crusader. He started a blog and set out to use whatever means were available to him to expose the corruption and lies of the Putin government. He realized that his training as a lawyer and some brief experience in finance could give him a foothold to challenge the system. He bought just a few shares of stock in some of the largest Russian oil and gas companies, which gave him standing to look at their books and challenge them in the courts. He noticed that these companies were paying far more than necessary to middlemen to sell the oil, people also connected to Putin, as much as $30 billion in total. They were skimming money from every barrel sold, he told me. So he sued them. My demand was very simple. Please explain why you are using this company to sell your oil. You could sell it directly. So why are you giving money to the closest Putin friends? Ironically, Putin's control over the media only heightened Navalny's profile online. By 2008, he realized that the censorship and intimidation of traditional media were driving more and more Russians to his form of internet activism and investigative journalism. There was no information at all, so people came to my blog to read something, and it became a sort of theater, a sort of show for people. Navalny was good at theater. In April 2008, he went to the annual shareholders meeting from the mysterious Russian oil giant, Surgut Neftegaz. The meeting was held in the city of Surgut, Siberia, in a cavernous old Soviet palace of culture. You can see all these tough Russian guys, Navalny said, recalling the scene. He got up to ask a question and grilled the CEO, Vladimir Bogdanov, about who the real owners of the company were. Bogdanov admitted that he didn't know. Another part of the show was the lawsuits against the oligarchs. Navalny offered to help people write complaints. Thousands of people wrote to him, and he established himself as a thorn in the side of Russia's new power structure. That's when he saw the political potential of what he was doing, a grassroots anti-corruption movement. The next step was direct fundraising for his efforts. And by 2009, he was raising money for what would become an anti-corruption foundation that now has several dozen offices across the country. But he never deviated from his core mission. Every day for years, he wrote an article for his blog detailing his anti-corruption efforts, the running script of a hit show. He chafed at the common charge that this made him a single-issue politician without a program other than anti-corruption. If you're fighting the regime, you're fighting corruption. Even though he was acting as an investigative journalist and media personality, he always thought of himself as a politician, albeit not a traditional one. This anti-corruption activity was sort of a camouflage for politics, he said. Because when you're suing Putin's friend for corruption, for stealing oil, of course it's politics. Still, he resisted joining any of the opposition political parties. To him, they had submitted to playing by the rules of a game that was rigged. I'm a politician, he said, but I don't have any political party. I realized that it's much better to be out of the game, to create your own game. As Navalny became more prominent, he confronted an apathy among Russians that was perhaps more widespread than their support for Putin. As the corruption of Russia's economy was impossible to ignore, one of Putin's goals was to discourage people from thinking that participation in politics was worth the effort. To accomplish that goal, he didn't need to convince people that he wasn't corrupt. He simply needed to convince people that everyone was corrupt. And the media gave him a huge platform to do that. They're promoting the idea that you can buy anyone. Everyone is corrupt. And the opposition, you can buy them like everyone else, Navalny said. In the same way that Nemtsov was cast as the force behind the corruption of the 1990s, Putin-friendly media cast Navalny himself as no different from Nemtsov and the reviled Anatoly Chubais, author of the privatization schemes. To be a Democrat was to be aligned with the corruption of those days and the political agenda of the Americans. Putin made a version of the same argument about other countries. He cast every government, every political model, as hopelessly corrupt as well. If that's the game, Russians might as well have a strong, competent leader who shares their grievances and sense of national greatness. It's just a business, Navalny said, characterizing Putin's argument. All over the world, it's the same rules. That's exactly what Putin is saying. The democracies, like America, were just as bad as anyone else. It's absolutely the same. They're just hiding it better. Everyone is corrupt. Everyone is cynical. There are no rules. There is no democracy. Every election is bought. Referring to Putin, Orban, and the corrupt strongmen who run most of the other Soviet republics, Navalny summed up their somewhat contradictory political message. 2 points of their agenda. First, the West is bad. They don't have any morality. Second, it's actually the same. The system is the same. Everyone is the same. On the one hand, it's easy to dismiss Putin's argument. In most of the world's democracies, the basic freedoms that Obama referred to in his 2004 speech are real. The idea that you can say what you want without getting a knock on the door, that you can start a business without paying a bribe. But America has also offered ample evidence to support Putin's message, even before we elected our own corrupt autocrat to the highest office in the land. I asked Navalny whether the 2008 financial crisis reinforced Putin's message that there was no difference between Russian corruption and the corruption of the West. Absolutely, he replied. The whole too-big-to-fail conception is a nice way to explain that there is no justice and there is the same corruption everywhere, including the USA. Think about it from a Russian perspective. You see your own billionaires and know they get rich because of their ties to Putin. Public resources, like oil and gas, handed off to a well-connected few. Criminal wealth laundered into real estate interests, shell companies, and dummy corporations. Then you look at America, and what do you see? You see American banks that took reckless risks getting bailed out, and you see billionaires profiting at every turn. The owners of oil and gas interests pouring money into politics. The wealthy able to avoid taxation by spreading their money around, moving it offshore, and creating their own shell companies. If you look carefully enough, despite the American rhetoric about democracy, the same wealthy Russians who everyone knows to be corrupt circulate in the same global elite. All these bastards, all these bad guys in the very black hats, Navalny said of the oligarchs he's tracked, they're absolutely fine with going to the U.S. and have meetings with the establishment, with the politicians. They are working it in Davos. All over the world, it's the same rules. In 2013, Navalny made his first foray into electoral politics, running for mayor of Moscow. After Putin announced his plan to return to the presidency in 2011, Navalny had begun acting more like a politician, speaking at a series of mass protests in Moscow that helped springboard his candidacy. His goal was to force the Kremlin-backed candidate into a runoff by denying him 50% of the vote. Despite having no access to traditional media and being harassed and constrained in his campaigning, Navalny cracked 30% and insists that his opponent fraudulently eked his way above 50%. It must have been clear to Putin then that Navalny wasn't just an irritant, he was a political threat. Perhaps not coincidentally, the years after Putin announced his return to the presidency are also the years when Navalny started to be arrested. Sometimes it was just a short-term detention or house arrest to break up a protest, but it would evolve into trumped-up charges on fraud and embezzlement. Being in prison allowed him to get to know a different cross-section of Russians, not just the Muscovite middle class, but also those on the margins of society. Insight that he said made him a better politician. But he's straightforward about the fear that goes with prison. "I'm a normal guy," he told me. "Of course I have a sense of danger. Of course it's uncomfortable when they're arresting you. Of course it's uncomfortable when you're in this cell and the metal door closes behind you. And you realize they can do anything." One of the things they did during one of his early stints in prison was poison him. The authorities claimed it was an allergic reaction. Though Navalny has never had any other allergic reactions, and poison has been a common political weapon in Putin's Russia. "They make this so obvious and so open," he said. "It is a message. It's a strange message, how they poison people inside Russia. They try to show that they can poison you, and maybe they can control you." Through the years of persecution, anger remained the sustaining force for Navalny. Some of that anger was directed not at the government, but at those who believe that Navalny is not actually an oppositionist. It's a subject that he came back to again and again. "It all started," he said, "when he confronted Bogdanov in Siberia and was allowed to ask his questions unmolested." From that point on, conspiracy theories started to spread that he was acting as an agent of Putin himself. "People were so shocked that they allowed me to go to the stage and say something about this company and criticize them to their face. They refuse to believe I'm doing it on my own. They think maybe I am FSB." These conspiracy theories ignored the sacrifices that Navalny made, the fact that his own brother was imprisoned for 4 years on trumped-up charges, some of that time in solitary confinement. So he found himself squeezed between doubters and parts of the opposition and a government that would clearly benefit from spreading conspiracy theories that Navalny is a double agent. Listening to him express incredulity at all this, it was hard for me not to think of the rampant conspiracy theories that have infected American politics, often amplified by Russian disinformation. Of course, those with power would want to make people think that their opponents are all part of the same game. He laughed at the absurdity of the conspiracy theory, entering a conversation that he's clearly had many times in his head. "Why do they not kill you? Could you explain why they haven't killed you?" he mimicked his critics. "And I have to explain, sorry guys, for not being killed." Despite his persecution at the hands of Putin and the maddening conspiracy theories that he's actually an agent of the Kremlin, Navalny spoke with a focused calm that channeled his outrage. He made his choice 2 decades ago to live this kind of life, when he faced judges running interference for corrupt real estate schemes. "If I need inspiration," he joked, "I would go to a Russian court, because what a Russian judge would do would give me inspiration." There was one more source of anger as well. Anger at himself. When Navalny was growing up, the Russian parliament had challenged Yeltsin's policies of liberalization in the early 1990s, right after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. A tense standoff ensued. The parliament attempted to impeach Yeltsin, and Yeltsin attempted to dissolve the parliament. Things came to a head that October, when Yeltsin responded to demonstrations with military force. More than 100 people were killed, and hundreds more wounded, and street battles that went on for nearly 2 weeks. This bloody circuit breaker allowed Yeltsin to consolidate his power and move forward with his reforms. "When I'm in prison, I think maybe it's payment for my support for these tanks that are shooting at the parliament," Navalny told me. "They came from the town that I grew up in. I was very supportive. They should crush them all. When I'm sitting in jail, I'm thinking all the time, maybe it's my personal payment for when I'm supporting them so much." It's not hard to see why Navalny poses a bigger threat to Putin than someone like Nemtsov, who carried with him an abiding faith in liberalism, who couldn't shake his association with the freewheeling days of the 90s. Navalny held tight to the more acute grievances of his time. The boy, humiliated by those rations from the West German army and the collapse of the Soviet Union. The man who saw successive corrupt administrations use the powers of government to steal from the people. He was not unlike many of those Russians who had originally turned to Putin after the 90s, and he was willing to be angry with himself for his own moment of trusting Russian authorities. He was relentlessly focused on the one vulnerability at the heart of Putinism, that for all the rhetoric about Russia, it's all just one big corrupt cabal. If Putin deflected those charges by pointing at the corruption of America, Navalny didn't bear any of the hallmarks of being in league with the Americans either. He hadn't featured in the color revolutions. Navalny is charming and gregarious over FaceTime, even as his grievances are not far beneath the surface. I recognized in him something that I'd felt myself, something that built during my years in politics and the years since. Visceral, dumbfounded anger at the circumstances around me, the lies, hypocrisy, and absurdity of it all. Incredulity that basic beliefs, like the need for a government that isn't corrupted by moneyed interest, should be so widely and fiercely contested. The sense of powerlessness in the face of conspiracy theories, in which you're cast as someone you're not. The feeling that a global enterprise has been built to sustain the power and wealth of a very particular group of people. Even his anger at himself for supporting Yeltsin recalled my anger at myself for believing the lies told in the run-up to the Iraq War right after I'd moved to Washington. Of course, the circumstances around him and the price that he has paid are far greater than anything I have experienced. But it was familiar all the same. A guy who didn't expect to be doing what he was doing, who was motivated by anger and yet still energized by the whole experience, incapable of doing anything else. 11. The Crimean War. Kiev Rus was a federation of ethnic Slavs founded by a Viking prince in the late 9th century. The kingdom spanned the territory from the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv to the Russian capital of Moscow and embraced the Orthodox Christianity that predominates in Russia to this day. In the 13th century, it was overrun by Mongol invaders and divided into separate nations. The fates of Russia and Ukraine have been intermingled ever since, through periods of union, war, and separation. An ethnic, religious, and psychic bond that continues to shape the idea of Europe, the identity of Slavs, and the politics of both countries. There was never any question that Putin's counter-revolution would come to this place, that, in his view, belonged to Russia. Otherwise, European democracy risked coming to Moscow through Kiev. In 2004, the Orange Revolution prevented a corrupt Ukrainian government loyal to the Kremlin from stealing an election. I remember a presentation at the Wilson Center from a former U.S. ambassador just back from Kyiv. Far from your typical think tank presentation, his overflowed with enthusiasm as he narrated a slideshow that captured, from the American perspective, this noble and slightly exotic revolution on Russia's doorstep. On a large screen, he showed pictures of the crowds along with protest leaders. Yulia Tymoshenko, a striking blonde with her hair braided like a Ukrainian Valkyrie, who has remained a political fixture drifting toward the nationalist right. Viktor Yushchenko, who would soon be poisoned and then serve a single term as president before being replaced by a corrupt government loyal to the Kremlin. Boris Nemtsov, who had turned up in Kyiv, speaking to larger crowds than he could in Russia, and went on to serve as an advisor to Yushchenko. But in that moment, 15 years after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the whole presentation on the Orange Revolution was premised on the continuum of freedom's inevitable spread. The enthusiasm I experienced during that presentation was rooted in an American certainty about progress, a faith in happy democratic endings. At the time, the Bush administration heralded the Orange Revolution as validation that its missionary zeal to spread democracy was bearing fruit. But the deck was stacked against the Ukrainians. While American attention would inevitably ebb and move on to other things, including the ongoing wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Putin had many cards to play in a country that shared a 1,200-mile border with Russia. The flow of oil and gas into Ukraine was controlled by Russia, which gave it enormous leverage. Russia also had deep reach into the wealthy class of oligarchs in Ukraine, the criminal underworld, and the security services. Plenty of levers to pull for a government that demonstrated the lengths that it was willing to go when it was almost certainly responsible for poisoning Yushchenko. Still, the Bush administration pressed ahead with an effort to pull Ukraine toward the West. By 2008, Ukraine and another former Soviet republic, Georgia, were invited to pursue action plans to join NATO, the first step toward membership in the military alliance. It was a move that touched Putin's most sensitive nerve, the encroachment of NATO into the former Soviet republics along Russia's borders. It was also hard to believe that Americans would be willing to go to war with Russia over these two former Soviet republics. Within a matter of months, in August 2008, Russia invaded Georgia and ended up occupying two of its provinces. Putin had been on his back foot when the Baltic countries joined NATO in 2004. By 2008, conditions were different. We were in the last weeks of the Obama campaign when the Georgia invasion took place. For a few days, John McCain sought to make Russia's aggression a central issue, but there was little appetite among the American public for his hawkish approach, especially with the Iraq War grinding through its sixth year. I remember a few frantic days of calibrating our line of support for Georgia with support for diplomacy, wondering how it was that America put itself out on a limb, offering membership in a mutual defense alliance to a country half a world away that most Americans had never heard of. Then, just a few weeks later, Lehman Brothers collapsed, and the attention of the American electorate and the entire world shifted to the financial crisis. By this point, Putin was safely ensconced in his behind-the-scenes role as prime minister, with Dmitry Medvedev as the frontman president. But the financial crisis was not without risk for Putin's broader enterprise. He could no longer rely on high oil prices that had buttressed his legitimacy, keeping the people and his corrupt networks fully satiated. If you look at the graph of oil prices, Zhanna told me, they skyrocketed from 1999 until 2008, and then they tumbled. I think you remember that, she said, laughing. During the inauguration of President Obama, with more precarious finances and economic circumstances at home, Putin knew he could brook little dissent and would have to dial up the nationalism that was his other source of legitimacy. On New Year's Eve, 2010, Zhanna accompanied her father to a modest demonstration in support of Article 31 of the Russian Constitution, which protects the right to peaceful demonstrations. By this point, she'd abandoned a career in politics. After the Orange Revolution, her emboldened father had urged her to run for Moscow's city council. Her competitor from Putin's party never campaigned, but he had a massive administrative advantage. On the day of the election, busloads of soldiers were taken to the polls to vote for him. Needless to say, she lost. She went to work for a time at an asset management firm, plugging into the burgeoning young Muscovite middle class. Nemtsov stood on a small platform and addressed the crowd, insisting on the rights guaranteed by Russia's post-Soviet constitution. Afterward, he did a television interview during which he introduced Zhanna as his eldest daughter. The video shows her smiling proudly. Shortly after the interview was over, with the camera still rolling, they were swarmed by special police units dressed all in black, who pulled Nemtsov away and put him on a police bus. Nemtsov, the once heir apparent to Yeltsin, was driven to a Moscow prison and thrown into a windowless cell with some other men. They shared a single toilet with no privacy and slept on a concrete floor. After 15 days, he was taken before a judge. I came to court, and he asked for a chair, and the judge refused to give him a chair, Jana recalled. So he stood for the whole process, and it lasted for 6-7 hours. I realized that the situation was getting tougher and tougher. Nemtsov's period of detention would be short-lived, but the effort at intimidation and threat of ambiguous consequences were now constant. In 2011, huge demonstrations broke out in Moscow after widespread claims of fraud in the parliamentary elections that returned Putin's party to power with a diminished majority. The opposition was motivated in part by Putin's announcement that he would run for another term as president in 2012. The turnout showed that beneath the layer of repression that cocooned public life, there were real pockets of opposition in the country. People who opposed Putin's return to power, shared Navalny's rage at corruption, and were generally dissatisfied with the direction of things. This, Jana recalled, energized her father, who ran in a regional election in 2013 and won a seat on a local council, returning to public office for the first time in over a decade. Echoing Navalny's tactics, he began to release reports about Putin with titles like 10 Years of Putin Outcomes, Putin's Corruption, and The Olympic Games in the Subtropics, which detailed how the 2014 Sochi Olympics resulted in tens of billions of dollars in corrupt rewards for Putin cronies. For Putin, the 2011 opposition to his return to power provided added motivation and incentive to dial up the nationalism. Splashy events like the Sochi Olympics were central to this strategy. So was a more assertive foreign policy that took an even sharper approach against the United States and the West. Edward Snowden was given sanctuary in Moscow. Russian support for Bashar al-Assad's murderous campaign against his own people steadily increased. Then, in 2014, there was a repeat of the Orange Revolution in Ukraine, as people occupied Kyiv's central square, the Maidan, for months, protesting a corrupt government loyal to the Kremlin. Despite a deal supported by Europe, the United States, and Russia that called for new elections, the corrupt pro-Kremlin president, Viktor Yanukovych, fled the country, taking refuge inside Russia. Protests against his man in Ukraine were an embarrassment to Putin, in addition to being a potential threat. Successful anti-corruption protests next door hit close to home. Within days, he dispatched Russian special forces into the Ukrainian province of Crimea and claimed it for Russia. Then, he invaded and occupied two provinces of eastern Ukraine. Putin had ignored the rules of the post-World War II order through his 19th-century-style annexation of a neighbor's territory, though he would consistently try to deflect accountability by pointing to America's invasion of Iraq and our meddling in the affairs of other countries. The machinery he'd built up for more than a decade, corrupt influence, irregular security forces, information warfare, was literally made for war in Ukraine. Despite the hit to Russia's economy from U.S. sanctions, taking a piece of Ukraine was sure to elevate his political standing at home. By this point, Jana was working as a journalist focused on the financial markets at RBC, a Russian business news channel. Crimea led to so-called patriotic euphoria in Russia, she recalled. Putin's rate of approval skyrocketed. It was incredible. It was literally 85%. And of course, those people who were critical, those rare voices, were under extreme pressure. So Putin refocused voters' attention from financial crisis, from electoral fraud, from other things, to this thing. Jana thought it might finally be time for her and her father to emigrate from Russia. But Nemtsov was adamant on staying. The fighting in eastern Ukraine soon became a brutal war that would take tens of thousands of lives. Putin denied that Russia was behind the violence, even as people like me and the U.S. government were putting out aerial imagery that showed huge supply lines of Russian military vehicles flowing across the border. To Jana, the cocktail of lies and nationalist fervor was just evidence of how everything, for Putin, is about nothing more than power. Nobody can explain what Putin means in ideological terms, in serious terms. Of course, it means corruption and dictatorship. But what the ideology is, nobody knows. So they proclaim some traditional set of values, this idea of imperial glories, something like that. It's a mix of religion and patriotism, but actually, they just used those as a tool. She laughed again. He had this slogan during one of his campaigns, "Putin's plan is the victory of Russia." Her laughter trailed off. It's very awkward. In June 2014, I traveled with Obama to Normandy to commemorate the 70th anniversary of D-Day. We arrived at the end of a long trip that had been devoted to shoring up European support for sanctions on Russia over its annexation of Crimea and invasion of eastern Ukraine. The effort had largely been a success, even as cracks emerged in the United Western Front. Several European countries held out, worried about losing Russian business. Others, like Hungary, showed little concern for what Putin had done. But Obama had strong-armed the key players, aided by Germany's Angela Merkel, and the event in Normandy would both underscore the historic bond of America's alliance with Europe and create an awkward diplomatic encounter with Putin. If there is a moment in my imagination that marks the emergence of the American superpower, it was June 6, 1944. You don't become the most powerful nation on Earth just because you happen to live an ocean away from the other empires, or have access to seemingly limitless natural resources. Primacy has to be earned at some point by a collection of human beings who do something hard. It was a moment without ambiguity. One side good, the other evil. The difficulty of charging on shore in a hail of gunfire is easy to understand. But to Russians, our devotion to commemorating D-Day obscured their own, much larger sacrifice. While we were planning an amphibious invasion, they were losing many millions of people holding out against the Nazis in places like Stalingrad, and then fighting mile by bloody mile to retake the heart of the Third Reich. The war touched every Russian in a way that it simply didn't touch Americans, reinforcing the long-standing sentiment that they always experienced the harder, more brutish aspects of the world. In our own retelling of the D-Day story, Americans defined ourselves. Obama used to talk to me about the old war movies set during or after the battle, how there was usually some unit at the center of the story that shorthanded the diversity of America. The wisecracking Jew from Brooklyn, the southern-accented sharpshooter, the Irish guy from Chicago, the jock from somewhere out west, all coming together to do this great and necessary thing. There wasn't usually a black guy, unless the cast was sprawling enough to have room for cooks and valets. Still, he saw something aspirational in this positive mythologizing of diversity, a national identity forged out of differences. For a person of my generation, Ronald Reagan crystallized the D-Day myth on the 40th anniversary of the Normandy landings. Standing with his back to cliffs scaled by American troops, he told the story of one unit of Rangers, how they'd fought and struggled and helped one another get over the top. Then he addressed those same Rangers, now gone gray, assembled before him. "These are the boys of Pend du Hoc. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. These are the heroes who helped end a war." My whole life, I had a hard time reading those words without getting chills. Simple and direct, even as I knew that the Reagan-era mythologizing of America's greatness ignored all the rougher edges. When I came into the White House as a speechwriter, I resolved to echo Reagan's tones in my first war speech. It came in Obama's second month in office, as he announced a timeline to draw down U.S. troops from Iraq. There would be none of the triumph of D-Day, no victory to mark, but there was still the same courage to honor. So I ended the speech with a tribute to two young Marines who had died in Iraq's Anbar province. In an age when suicide is a weapon, they were suddenly faced with an oncoming truck filled with explosives. These two Marines stood their ground. These two Marines opened fire. These two Marines stopped that truck. The heroism lay not in the liberation of a continent, but in saving the lives of their fellow Americans. "Their names are written on bridges and town squares," I wrote. "They are etched into stones at Arlington and in quiet places of rest across our land. They are spoken in schools and on city blocks. They live on in the memories of those who wear your uniform and the hearts of those they loved and in the freedom of the nation they served. These are words I wanted to believe about post-9/11 America and its wars. But whereas D-Day had been unambiguous, everything about our time seemed to be the opposite. Instead of scaling cliffs to liberate allies, we'd asked our troops to fight off suicide truck bombs in a country that didn't want us there. While we used to unite around a president commemorating our history overseas, Obama's every utterance and gesture was scoured by Republicans looking to cast him as less than American. The Soviet enemy used to compel us to carve out a space where we set aside our differences. But my time in the White House was marked by unprecedented vitriol directed against the president I served. A black man had been put in charge of the unit, and that didn't sit well with a lot of Americans. Putin, by contrast, was firmly in command of a brand of nationalism that was becoming increasingly attractive, not just to Russians, but to factions of the Republican Party in the United States. We spent the night before the Normandy commemoration in Paris. I was done with my work for the trip, since the D-Day events were purely ceremonial. So a group of us went out on the town. Over the course of the night, more of my French came back with each drink, and I proudly directed a series of taxi drives to after-hours spots for a dwindling number of us. Finally, fortified by absinthe and wine, a small group euphorically trekked to Notre Dame at sunrise. It had been a tough year, what with Ukraine, the rise of ISIS, a creeping Ebola outbreak, and ceaseless Republican investigations back home. With just over 2 years left in the 8 years allotted to us, the night felt like a respite, a chance to blow off steam in the city that America had liberated 70 years earlier. By the time we got to Normandy the next morning, my euphoria had turned into a hangover that carried the weight of the last several years. Like Reagan, Obama stood near the channel and spoke. "If prayer were made of sound," he said, "the skies over England that night would have deafened the world. Captains paced their decks. Pilots tapped their gauges. Commanders pored over maps." The story was the same, but I figured it would not be received that way back home from an opposition that preferred to insist that Obama apologized for America abroad. After Obama's speech, he joined the other world leaders at a grand lunch in a sprawling chateau. As I nibbled on pastries and nursed a glass of red wine in a staff area adjacent to the chateau, Pete Souza, Obama's photographer, came running in my direction. "Come on," he shouted, gesturing wildly. "He's meeting with Putin." A surge of adrenaline roused me. Obama hadn't been face to face with Putin since the annexation of Crimea. Whatever they discussed was likely to be summarized inaccurately by the Russians, and of immense interest to the media. I jogged a few paces behind Pete into the chateau, ignoring the prohibition on staff, a typically American assertion of superpower status that becomes second nature when you serve in government. I dodged world leaders like a kick returner as I made for Obama and Putin in the center of the room. It wasn't hard to find them. In a surreal scene, many of the dozens of leaders present were standing and holding smartphones up in the air, taking pictures of the interaction like paparazzi outside an award ceremony. As I took my position just behind Obama, I was relieved to see that Susan Rice, the National Security Advisor, was already present. Obama leaned down over the much shorter Putin, urging him to pursue a plan for peace negotiations with the leaders of Ukraine, France, and Germany, an arrangement that would become known as the Normandy Group. Putin agreed, but he obfuscated about what he was doing in eastern Ukraine. He also, strangely, told his aide how attractive Susan was and blew her a kiss. When the meeting was over, the adrenaline drained out of me. I went in search of a restroom, somewhere I could splash some cold water on my face and consider how to read the meeting out to the press. Finding one, I tried to open the door. In that awkward moment when you don't know whether a door is stuck or locked, I pushed against it a few times, jiggling the knob, before taking a step back, resolved to the fact that someone was in there. Just then, the door opened, and out walked the Queen of England. She was unaccompanied, given that the area was supposed to be reserved for leaders only. She stood ramrod straight, looked me up and down with a glance that would have once sent someone to the gallows, and walked away. Solemnly, we then all filed out to a series of bleachers that had been erected on a beach that the Allies had stormed 70 years earlier, the English Channel in the near distance. Whether out of some French sense of diplomacy or simple mischief, the American delegation was seated directly in front of the Russians. As I took my seat, I noticed that the omnipresent Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, was seated directly behind me, alongside a row of sullen-looking men. Lavrov was a survivor, having served in the position for over a decade, defined by loyalty to Putin, a capacity to strike up friendships with adversaries, and a casual willingness to lie. A jumbotron in front of us showed the different world leaders taking their places. The camera settled on Putin, and the crowd booed loudly. Then it shifted to Obama, and a cheer rang out. I think of that moment as one last expression of the world's preference for a particular brand of politics, before it was eclipsed by the darker forces that found expression in Brexit and Donald Trump. Perhaps sensing the drama of the moment, the French jumbotron operator switched the image to a split screen of Obama and Putin, a diplomatic audiovisual play that forced the crowd to cheer for both of them, two embodiments of very different views of how politics should function in the world. To mark the occasion, the French had choreographed a series of interpretive dances, acting out the key events of World War II. The dances took place on a huge map of Europe that had been placed atop the sand where men once charged into bullets. I didn't fully grasp the concept until a group of dancers dressed in black uniforms, meant to be the Gestapo, took captive a group of dancers dressed in overalls, meant to be Jews. The only way to know exactly which part of World War II was being reenacted was to watch the jumbotron, which showed footage of events ranging from the Holocaust to the surrender of German troops. After some time watching this, I gave up and just stared vacantly at the dancers. Lavrov, I noticed, was doing the same. Reviving my recent embarrassment, one video reel showed a young Queen Elizabeth serving as a wartime driver and mechanic, symbol of the unified efforts of an entire generation. Obama was sitting next to the Queen, and there was something hopeful at the thought of this pairing of the West's fortitude in the face of fascism and its capacity to change, a reminder that despite all the mistakes and hypocrisy and corruption, we were still the good guys. Whatever world order could generate that pairing had something to offer the world that was worth fighting for. The evolution from empires to liberated colonies. The fortitude of the wartime generation bridging the meritocratic elevation of someone born with brown skin and no wealth or station to the highest office in the world. A rebuke to dictators who still see maps as something to be redrawn at the muzzle of a gun. But I also knew, even then, that the picture obscured the virus that was spreading within the West. Even as the two of them occupied those chairs, there was a creeping sense that the whole enterprise risked being eaten away from within and without. When the ceremony was over, I met up with Obama. "You know," he said, "there's something cheesy about the cultural programs at these European events sometimes." He recalled the different event at which the Dutch had opened a summit devoted to preventing nuclear terrorism with a performance that included dancing robots. "I didn't think I'd ever see the Holocaust reenacted by dancers," I said. Obama told me that he'd found himself wondering what the Queen thought, having lived through the Blitz. "Can you imagine what Putin thought sitting there?" Obama said. "He probably thought Russia did a lot more to win the war," I answered. "No," Obama said. "He probably thought, man, the West has gotten soft." In February 2015, the Normandy Group, established during that meeting between Putin and Obama, reached an agreement in the Belarusian city of Minsk to resolve the war in eastern Ukraine, a formula by which autonomy would be granted to the affected regions and the Russian-backed separatists would disarm. The fighting slowed, but did not stop. Around this time, Zhanna moderated a television program because a colleague was on vacation. She invited three guests onto the show: the chair of the Russian Duma's Committee on Defense, a separatist from Eastern Ukraine, and an organizer of a